pod. Hi. There are a lot of you. You'll have to forgive me. I'm a little breathless. I drove up from New York City today after having replaced the battery in my car. So I'm a little flustered. But thank you so much for having me here. It's a little intimidating that I am standing here in this room full of extraordinary people because I wrote a blog about Julia Child. It seems strange. You know, that this thing that I began in after a fit of existential panic has brought me here 7 years later. So, in those 7 years, a lot has happened. It's been a sort of steady ramping up of the surreal, so gradual that much of the time it kind of goes unnoticed. Sort of like how if you put lobsters in a pot of cold water and you turn the water on and heat on, and by the time it's boiling, they don't realize that they're being boiled alive until it's too late. But in a good way, because in August of 2002, I was a 29-year-old secretary living in Queens, working in a government agency, and I was frustrated and scared and pretty much hopeless about any career prospects. Sorry to say, students, I moved. I left Amherst and convinced to work as a temp for 7 years. But it does get better. And what got better for me was that something happened, and I can't really explain it. It was like sort of a Reese's peanut butter cup moment, that the panic of being a frustrated writer plus the daily comfort of my cooking, which was enthusiastic if not always accomplished, and this obsession with this certain 40-year-old cookbook and the woman who wrote it all smashed together. And out of that explosion came this blog, the Julia Project. 365 days, 524 recipes, one crappy Outer Borough kitchen was actually the original title. My publishers didn't want to put crappy on the book cover, so we settled for tiny, which was a bit of a fib. It was just god-awful, so not so much tiny. So I didn't start the blog so I could get a book deal or have a movie made about me. I didn't know a blog could do that. I didn't really know what a blog was. I mean, this was August of 2002, and my husband says, "Oh, you should do a blog." And I said, "What? I don't use these words. I don't understand." But I started it because I needed something in my life that was my own, something that compelled me. And Julia Child did that. Cooking her food and writing about it did that. So I cooked and I wrote, and my husband washed Everest-sized piles of dishes. And we were so consumed with that that it took us a while to realize that someone other than my mother was reading what I was writing, and that someone was compelled by me being compelled. I think really my talent, if to the extent that I have one, is being at the right place in the right time. And I've been very, 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 very lucky. I was lucky to have started what I did when I did as blindly as I did, as one could only have done in 2002 before the blogosphere exploded. It was a little, much, much smaller pond. And I happened to come upon something that compelled my readers. I'm lucky to have those readers. I call my readers my bleeders, which is really corny but apt, because they were devoted and crazy and kept me going and encouraged me and interacted with me on a daily basis and, you know, thought I should run for president and called the New York Times and said, "What the hell are you doing not writing about this woman?" And eventually they listened to me, and I got this piece that Amanda Hesser, Amanda Hesser, wrote on the cover of the dining section of the New York Times, and that was luck. The book deal, luck. The movie option, luck. Nora Ephron coming on board is like insane luck. And I'm not saying this because out of some kind of adorable sheer, you know, self-deprecation tick, though I think that that is in order in a room like this full of so many extraordinary students and professors and alumni and donors and wonderful people. So I cop to thinking self-deprecation is allowed, but But what I'm really trying to say is that, to put into some context of how fortunate I've been and how profoundly my life has been changed by following Julia Child's example. Julia was a wonderful cook and a wonderful writer. In working through mastering, I got better at both of those things. But to me, Julia, and I hate to just go on and on and on about a smithy on Amherst Day, but but to me, Julia was as much a feminist as a culinary icon. And the reason why is this. She cooked the way she lived, with spirit, vigor, humor, and nary a thought for those who thought they knew what her limits were. Julia made herself, very literally. And she did it by matter-of-factly refusing to accept the declared boundaries. For her, the kitchen was a place of empowerment rather than drudgery. It's telling to me that when this book came out in 1961, right on the eve of the modern feminist movement, hordes of women went back to the kitchen, but in a new way, not to feed the kids or impress the hubby's, you know, boss, but not as oppressed housewives, but to feed themselves. And I don't mean just the bœuf bourguignon, though the bœuf bourguignon is good. Julia inspired me to live in a bigger, braver way, to see possibility, and that seems to me an inherently feminist idea. I'm an avid watcher of Mad Men, and I am thinking of writing Matt Wiener a very strongly worded letter if he doesn't soon get a copy of Mastering into the hands of Joan or Peggy. Though I do think that Betty's headed over into feminine mystique territory. So, back to this surreal ramp thing I was talking about before. Since August 2002, I have burned bœuf bourguignon that I was cooking for legendary editor Judith Jones after passing out from too many vodka gimlets. I have eaten lunch with Nora Ephron at Balthazar before a foot-high stack of my entire blog printed out on pink paper, because she only reads pink paper. I have seen online paparazzi shots of Amy Adams playing Julie Powell, wandering my city outside the place I used to work, at the Strand, on a corner beneath the 7 train that I could see from my window in Queens. It was like I was being stalked by this movie. I have a... I'm losing my place. I have talked 21st century sexual politics of high heels with Meryl Streep, dressed as Julia Child. I had the first thing she said to me when I met her for the first time, when she looked at me and she said in her Julia voice, "You're so tall." I think she was a little distressed that she was having to spend so much time pretending to be 6'2". I have seen myself played on screen by someone much smaller, prettier, and sweeter than me. I have seen my husband portrayed on screen by someone who is uncannily like him. I have worn hair extensions. I have been on red carpets. I have seen Amy Adams sip a mini champagne bottle with a little sippy cup attachment to it so as not to spill on her dress. I have ridden in a car with David Cross, which, for those of you who know him, is kind of scary. And I have eaten dinner with Joss Whedon, who, for the 10 people out there who know who he is, will realize is a very, very big thing for me. And now I'm here. And dinner was on Thursday. It was lovely. And it's, you know, it's a rabbit hole. Curiouser and curiouser, and I like it down here. But really, and I realize I'm talking really fast and I have nothing more to say, so I'm going to make this up. But I think the real thing, the most surreal thing, and it's still surreal to me, whenever it occurs to me, it's more surreal than getting text messages from movie stars or being played on the big screen, is that I'm a writer now. 15 years after graduating from Amherst, after 7 years of being lost and unhappy. I think I finally made good, and I do what I love for a living. And that is, that will never cease to be surreal. That is the most very, 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 very surreal thing in my life, and I'm very grateful for it. And you know, it's thanks to you guys by a kind of vicarious route, but I came back, so I'm just thrilled. And shoot, I have been talking not nearly long enough. So my car broke down today. I guess what I'll go back to, what I always go back to, is Julia and what the experience of that year was for me. I think I spent my 20, I think the temp jobs, and I had so many of them, were a symptom of being afraid of making a commitment. A commitment seemed like a narrowing to me. Well, if I take this job at the Asian American Businesses Underwriting Department in AIG, then that's what I am. If I take a job at the Xerox concession at the UN, that's what I am. And that seemed, you know, rightfully so, terrifying. But I refused to commit. I was always floating, looking for some wonderful thing that was going to happen to me. And so with the project, this looking down the barrel at 30, which is, you know, the end of the world, I finally made this leap out of... Ooh. It's creepy. Ooh. Yes. I will absolutely. I give great questions.
I have a question.
Yes.
Okay. Since you went to New York to become an actress, were you ever thinking you would like to play you on the big screen?
Oh God, no. God, I want someone to play me who will sell tickets. I long ago gave up the acting ghost. It's funny. I was so protected as a student here, and I did such great work. And then you go out there, and you know you're waiting in line with 300 people for, you know, bimbo number three. And I am not equipped to play bimbo number three. And well, in some ways yes, in some ways no. But by the time the movie was coming out, I actually had someone ask me that. I was like, God, no, you need to get Kate Winslet or someone. And so I actually signed with the people who would not cast me. So, yeah, I would have liked a little cameo. That would have been nice. Like, they gave everybody and their dog a cameo, and they didn't give me one. That was kind of irritating. But, yeah, anyway. Yes. I'm vaguely familiar with it. I haven't read it, but I know the concept. Yeah.
And the other one is, today in the car, by coincidence, I heard a story on NPR about a pie. Someone is making a pie a day.
Oh, yes. I'm trying to remember the person's name. But yes.
It sounded like a takeoff on you.
Well, you know, the year-long project scheme is, I mean, it's as old as the hills, but... in terms of the blog world, it's definitely become quite the thing. And I wouldn't say that I spawned it or I spawned. It makes it sound like I've created something evil. But I will say that what I think is that the blog medium, and this is something that I didn't have any idea of when I began, because I began when none of us understood what the medium could do. It is a uniquely fabulous medium for obsession, which makes it a natural for me. And it really, I mean, people, bloggers, successful bloggers, great bloggers are the ones who come up with a concept or a subject or something that just eats away in their brain all the time. And getting that onto the screen is that becomes And that's what drives a good blog. So yeah, I mean, I think it becomes a very natural progression. There's a great thing about a year-long project because it's nice, it's a big chunk, and yet there's a light at the end of that tunnel and a destination that you're getting to that you can see. So yeah, I mean, I think it's very popular for very good reasons. Yes. Sure. I should at first say that Amy Adams is a lovely actress, and I think she did a wonderful job of playing someone who isn't really me. It was necessary for the movie. It's for one thing, it's PG-13. You get one fuck, and it wasn't mine. That right there is a difference. I think that it's interesting. I've thought about this a lot. I think, you know, in general, the character as portrayed by Amy, as written by Nora, she's much sweeter. There's a lot of the rough edges have been polished down. It's interesting because in some ways, Julie and Julia the movie is a movie about a book. It's a movie about how mastering the art of French cooking was created and who it affected. And it is about writing to some degree. But I think it's because depicting the act of becoming a writer on screen is very, very difficult. So it became more about the quest to get a book deal and the quest to cook lots of food, which are easier things to depict. I think that as a result of that, the Julie Powell of the movie is, she's not a funny person. She's a person to whom funny things happen. Whereas one of the achievements I thought of the year, I mean, I love that I can make a good boeuf bourguignon now, but more important even than that is that I managed to find my voice as a writer, find that I could entertain people and that was something viable. One of my great memories of the year was having being on the phone with my mom, my oh so supportive mother, and saying, you know, we were sort of marveling that all these people were reading and commenting, and I said, you know, I never thought I was funny before, and she says, yeah, neither did I. Great. I think the character is a little less self-aware than I am. Nothing if not insanely self-aware. I mean, I wish I could turn that little switch off. But in terms of what was right with the movie, with her, the relationship with the husband to me feels very, very authentic. Her drive feels really right on, the core of the drive. And the parts where she was on the floor throwing things around was right. That part was right. I do have like the little list of little quibbly things that drive me nuts. That are Dean and DeLuca appears in the movie. I hate Dean and DeLuca. I hate it. And in the book, I write that it's, you know, the grocery of the Antichrist. I hate it. So to have Dean and DeLuca in there kind of made me mad. Having her stand in front of a Scharfenberger chocolate fountain and going ooh. Bothered me. Though it was interesting because it was sort of a period detail because you never see chocolate fountains anymore. But in 2002, and the only other thing that irritated me was that she said, and again, I understand why it had to be, discussing why Julia Child was not a fan, saying, do you think it was because I used the F word so every once in a while? It's like, the F word? Like, I have literally never said that in my life. And, I only say it when I'm referring to foodies because I hate that word. But other than that, you know, I think they got a lot right, and I love the way that they made the parallels between this one woman's struggle and the great woman who inspired her having her own struggle. I thought it was really beautifully done. Yes. Yes.
So what was it like having Julia Child
right to it, shall we? It was, of course, and I mean, it happened pretty much the way it happens in the movie. I got a call from a reporter who had been interviewing her, and she was kind of a pill. And basically, and it was devastating to me. And when that happens, when you've devoted your year and your life to someone who has been such an extraordinary inspiration and influence, and that doing something that you absolutely feel is an homage and a tribute, and that she's, you know, a woman who's changed your life, have her say, is awful at the when you first. I mean, it's unbelievable. And I cried and was hysterical, and then, you know, I started thinking about it. And first of all, two things I thought. One, if anyone on this earth is entitled to her opinion, it's Julia Child. She has earned it. Two, one of the things that, you know, and I was speaking before about Julia being a feminist icon to me. And the reason she is that way is that she just lived life knowing that the person that she had to prove to, the person that she had to live up to, was herself. And she taught me that. And so now I, you know, after a while, after, you know, sucking back the wheezing sobs, I began to realize I know what this project was, and I know what it meant to me, and I know how sincere it was. And if she thought, you know, she wanted to send me baskets of puppies and rainbows, that would be great. But it's not a mutual admiration society. I don't love Julia Child because she loves me. I love Julia Child because everything she has given to me and so many thousands of people. That's kind of the way I learned to accept it. And it's been useful in later years. When the movie comes out, there's this whole new round of people who think I'm a twit. And that lesson has continued to be very, very useful to me. Stay the course. I know what I'm doing and why I'm doing it, and I own that. So she taught me a lot. Yes?
Do you still cook?
I still cook. I'm one of those New Yorkers, crazy New Yorkers, who we cook 5 days a week at least. You know, sometimes it's chicken sandwiches, but it's chicken sandwiches from my chicken. Obviously, I cook much, much more simply, for a couple of reasons. I mean, nobody needs to be eating out of Mastering every day of their lives. Also, this is a whole other thing, is that my new book is about learning to be a butcher, and I worked in this amazing butcher shop in upstate New York called Fleischer's, and they only serve the good stuff. You know, it's local, it doesn't have any nasty things in it, and it's happy meat. And I've gotten to be such a meat snob that I won't eat anything but the good stuff. So I'm eating less meat, and I'm eating, and when I get the good stuff, you don't have to massage it into anything. You just done. You know, that's it. And then so I eat much more simply than I do. But I also have it, you know, it's the year, the frantic year of cooking through Mastering has left me much more serene in the kitchen and able to handle whatever comes down. My husband cooks more now, and you just, you know, you're sitting there on the couch and you're hearing the, damn, oh, damn, oh, damn. And it's like, can I come in and help, dear? Because he just doesn't have that. He just gets all. So anyway, long answer, but yes.
Your life must have changed dramatically after all of this. And I'm just interested in how you respond to all the invitations you must get, your appearance, but also your normalcy of your former life.
Well, it's strange how, you know, in some ways my life is completely, as I said, totally surreal. And I mean, the fact that I'm here and that I'm going to be someplace else next week, and then it is amazing. And, you know, you don't ever get over seeing your picture in a magazine. It's just bizarre. I'm always like, but it's surprising how, I mean, aside from the explosions of book tours and, you know, when the movie came out, that was 3 weeks of amazing craziness. I loved visiting that crazy place, and I am really glad I don't live there. Because really, my day-to-day life is, it's like the shiny, happy version of the life I was living before. I'm still living in Queens. Another apartment, thank Christ. I still cook. I still walk my dog. I still, you know, go to the grocery store and go to therapy and, you know, and I just do it. So it's like my daily life is very prosaic. The big thing that's different is that my daily life consists not of answering phones and printing out diaries cards and freaking out every day. I'm doing the thing that I love, or not choosing not to do it, and you know, watching some Hulu. But is extraordinary. It's such a small change, but it's everything. It's everything to me. Yes. Favorite food blogs. I will confess that I'm not a great food blog keeper upper wither, which is terrible. I love the Amateur Gourmet. Adam Roberts is a friend of mine. I think he's fantastic. Kathy Irway has a blog called Not Eating Out in New York. So clearly we have some similar. She actually has a book coming out, and you should all buy it. But it's about her. She spent a year not eating out in New York. And she, what I love about her is that she's very passionate about a lot of the things I'm very passionate about, local foods and sort of saving our food industry. And she writes about it very entertainingly. So I think those are two that I really do keep up with. Yes?
Despite your mother, have you ever considered doing stand-up?
Thank you. Yes. Well, it was a culture shock for sure. Coming from Austin, Texas, to this tiny little town, and it took some getting used to. I actually started cooking in college because my sophomore year at college, I lived in the boiler room, literally, Milliken Dorm, I think it was called, which has since been knocked down. God bless us all. And it was miserable. And yeah, I was convinced that people in Massachusetts just don't know how to eat. So I started cooking so I could eat chicken fried steak and gumbo and fajitas and enchiladas and very unfortunate experience with barbecue. So it took some getting used to. It took some adjustment to dealing with. But I kind of bottomed out sophomore year. Sophomore year was bad. And then because I was living in a boiler room. But, and now, by the end of it, I just loved it. You know, it's a small place. And I think especially in winter, especially when you're a Texan, it gets a little claustrophobic. But then you get to go to is the Haymarket bookstore still here? Do you know that? Haymarket? Maybe I may be giving the wrong name. It's the one that the mill that's over the old mill. Montague. Okay. Why do I have Haymarket? Anyway, I'm going there tomorrow. I love it. You know, there's so much. You know, and of course I have such. What is it called?
The Book Mill.
Thank you. I don't know where that Haymarket thing came from. And of course I have so many friends that I still cherish. And Facebook with every day. So I thought it was an extraordinary experience. I was so lucky to get to come here, and I felt so nurtured as well as challenged. So that was great. You have to assume. I mean, especially for a writer, and especially, the way my book deal came about was so stupid, really. I mean, I am what's wrong with publishing today. Threw this amazing amount of money at me that I have yet to earn out. And, you know, just threw me into this very kind of high-end thing, and then the movie comes, and it's you have to remember that every... that next check you get in the mail could be the last one you're going to get. And thus be grateful for every moment that you have, because, you know, you can see why people get to be jerks. I mean, if you take that for granted for 1 second, I was on the tour for the movie, and I was in Detroit, and I had to get up at 5:45 and get my makeup all done and get all pretty, and because I was going to be on some local TV or something. And after that, it all happened. You know, the guy comes to my room, and he dresses, and it's this really fancy room, and gets me all done, and we're walking out the door to go to the show, and I say, "Oh, I wish I'd brought a straw because I need my morning diet Pepsi, and I don't want to mess up the makeup." And so, no big deal. There was a hotel or a restaurant in the hotel. We just grabbed a straw and went on our way. I drink my Diet Pepsi. All is well. Then I get on a plane and I go to Chicago, or get in a car and go to Chicago. And I have another event in the evening. Get there a little early. I'm going to the green room. And there are 12 straws of different, you know, there's a bendy one. There's a blue one. There's a little red stirry one. And you know some poor Borders, you know, cashier was getting the call. "We need, Julie Powell needs straws." "What kind? I don't know. Get them all." and you can get, if you don't remember how completely absurd that is, you can get stupid. I am assuming that it's going to settle into some other place where I'm going to be, hopefully, as long as I'm a writer and people publish me, I'm going to be happy. But once you start writing novels, it's all going to be downhill, you know?
Julie, how did your husband respond to seeing your life, on screen?
Well, my husband is a very reserved person. To be honest, I mean, I'm a narcissist. I like standing up here and answering your questions and having people love me. But my husband's not that way at all. And so it's been uncomfortable for him in several different ways. Just the fact of, you know, the first time we had a screening, he's like, I can't go. You have to report back and tell me how awful it is. And so I had to go back and say, Chris Messina is adorable. It's great. But he's slowly trying to get used to it, but his tactic is to kind of, you know, step back 3 feet and let, you know, what's happening to me be what's happening to me. He gets really, really bored of every time he goes into a room with his office colleagues saying, "Oh, what's Julie doing today?" He's like, you know, hey, you know, his editor, who's I'm not going to say he's senile. He's a little older. And he asks about me like 5 times a day. And it's like, really? Really? His therapist once said that he had given my book to his wife, which is highly inappropriate for a psychotherapist to say that. But so it's irritating. But he's, you know, he's an extraordinarily patient guy, and he's been through a lot. And I'm lucky to have him. So anyone else? There's a blue hand. Yes, there you are. Oh, it's so hard. The question was, what is the favorite dish that I made that year? And it's an insane question. That's like asking, what's your favorite book? It's like, there's no way. But that said, I've sort of divided it up into several kinds of favorite. There's the favorite, I love it. I cook it when I can, when I have the time, and it's always satisfying. And really, I think it's the heart of mastering is, and I keep mentioning this, the bœuf bourguignon. It's literally in the center of the book, and it's a beautiful. I think the recipe qualifies as art. It's an extraordinarily structured, clear, lucid, beautiful recipe, and I love. I always say it's cooking through that recipe for me is like doing a paint by numbers Caravaggio. It's not going to make me Caravaggio, but it gives me insight into what Julia's genius was, and then it's bœuf bourguignon at the end. So that's my I'm just going to leave it at that. That's my very, very favorite one. Yes.
How did your fascination with Julia Child begin?
Okay, I was about 11, And I discovered, and this is in my book, and it didn't make it into the movie, and you'll figure out why. I discovered, and in my mind, I discovered the two books like within days of each other. I was a really, really picky kid. I would not have eaten anything in the book, nothing. But I was a bookworm. I was fascinated by books. The bigger, the older, the smellier, the better. And so I found this book in my mom's pantry and started flipping through this book. And it just so happened that 2 days before, in my mind it was 2 days before, I had found another book in my father's medicine cabinet. And Joy of Sex. And I perused it with this, I mean, I knew I wasn't supposed to be looking at this. But there were all these French words, and there were these really disturbing drawings, and I didn't understand what any of it meant, but I wanted to know. 11 is a dangerous year for girls, because we want to know. And so when I started flipping through Mastering the Art, it was a very similar experience. There's all these French words, there are all these weird drawings, I don't understand what's going on. And so that it kind of sunk into my subconscious. I didn't, you know, it was just there. It was this totemic presence. And then later, you know, I came to college. I started to teach myself to cook. I moved to New York, started getting, you know, burning less food and getting to be a pretty good cook. And it floated to the top of my brain again. And I'd never watched a Julia Child show. So my experience of Julia Child from the beginning was the book. And I remember picking it up again and reading it as you would read a novel, not to cook out of, with no particular intent of cooking out of it, just to read it. She's not given enough credit for being an extraordinary writer. She is lucid, and there's this humor that comes. She comes out of the pages in a way that's a difficult thing to do, especially when you're writing a, you know, tome of a cookbook. But that's really what spoke to me about the book. That and the fact that the structure of it is so profound. If you want to learn to really be a cook, and so many thousands of women have done this, this is the way to do it. It's structured like a cooking class. It's a beautifully thought out cooking class. And it started early, and then it got a little more practical a little later on. But she's always been kind of floating around in the old brain pan. This is not my brain pan, but this brain pan. So yeah. Not really. I have tremendous respect for recipes and the people who write them. I don't think that I'm particularly, that's a particular talent of mine. I could be wrong. It could happen. But right now I feel too insecure I don't really dare to write a cookbook. We'll see. Maybe once I've gained some life experience, it'll all make more sense. Yes. Well, Martha Stewart did it before I did it, as she makes very plain. In my travels, talking on book tours, I'm constantly being approached by women who say, men and women who said, I did this in the 60s or the 70s or the 80s, and this changed me. I mean, you were saying yourself, it's a book that gets people deeply involved and pulls them in, and it has the capacity to really change not just how you eat and how you cook, but how you kind of approach life and projects and challenges. So,
wait, my second question is there another book that's sort of like in the brain pan that you're thinking, oh my God, now I have to try every recipe?
Oh God, I don't want to be that woman. I mean, there are fabulous books. You know, one that's, again, because I've been doing the butchery book and gotten so obsessed with meat, the River Cottage meat book by a man with a very long name who is British, it has that potential. It's very intimidating. It's beautiful. It's huge. It's bigger than Mastering the Art of French Cooking. It's enormous. And it has serious you know, you got your hearts, you got your, you know, pork belly, you got your kidneys, and and it's all in this very matter of tact tone. So this is what you do with the kidneys, or like pig liver or something, and so that like that entices me and scares me, and when it scares me, that's a good sign, I think. I tasted every aspic. I won't say that I devoured them all with relish, but that was part of the deal. Is I had to taste at least everything. The cold poached egg and aspic didn't clean my plate, but I got through them. I tasted them. Anyone? Oh, right. Yeah, both of you, one and then the other. Congratulations, or condolences. I don't know. Yeah. Well said. Yeah, I think it's words that parents should hear. I know lots of people who took consultants' jobs right out of college and are doing very well for themselves, and you know, more power to them. But to find an authentic life for yourself. I tend to think, especially if you're a creative person or in a creative field, but really no. I mean, it's everyone. Everyone needs to find that life is not. It's one thing that I've really learned in the last few years, actually, that we tend to think that we need to hit the points, you know. And I did that. I graduated. I moved to New York. I went to an audition, and another, and then stopped. I got married. You know, I got married young because that was the next thing, and. You know, I did all these things, and what it took me a long time to realize, and what I didn't realize at the time, and it's only in retrospect, was all that fermenting that I was doing with the trying to make ends meet and being frustrated and not, you know, having an answer when my mom said, "So what are you gonna do?" Luckily, I was very fortunate in that my parents didn't push me to settle or to figure out to just do something for the sake of. You know, don't go to law school. I was very fortunate in that way. Though she did keep trying to get me to move back to Austin. But it's not a dotted line, you know. And one of the things that Julia taught me that I was feeling like I was looking down a corridor, and that as I got older, you know, God, I'm going to be 30. The doors were shutting and locking, and I had fewer and fewer options. And what the project really taught me was that the rabbit hole analogy is very apt, I think, that there's lots more than doors. You can go up in the vents. You can, you know, there's going to be a hole in the floor. The elevator's going to be broken, or there are all kinds of, you know, go into the electrical closet and, you know, it's Narnia. Who knows? It's exploring out all of those. In working out all of those possibilities that you didn't recognize were possibilities. And that takes time. And it takes, you have to, you know, make some dog legs and go around and you hit some dead ends. But that's part of the process. And I have to have faith that deep below where you think you know what you're doing, there's something churning. And one day you will. I'm getting into a vomit metaphor here, which is not where I wanted to go. But the fear of continuing to not know will be offset, will become bigger than the fear of trying something you're scared of. And that's the moment. That's the key moment. And it takes some time to get there. It's sort of like, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous or something. You know, people talk about hitting rock bottom, the moment where I have to change or I have to die. And for me, that was the project. I had to change, and it didn't make sense, and no one, you know, people weren't going, oh, yes, that's a very smart and wise and practical idea. But it felt right, and it felt, the voice in my head said, this is what you need to do. Just trust me on it. And I think parents, especially in times like this, obviously we all know that things are tough out there right now. So it's hard to not just grab at financial straws, take the job. And you're going to have to do some of that. But you have to keep open to that voice, because when it comes, it's going to steer you in the right direction. I believe that. I'm naive, but it worked for me and has continued to work for me. So, yeah. Okay. So I talked the whole hour. Thank you, guys. I'm so much better at this Q&A stuff. But I'm going to have one more question. Oh, it was you, sir. You get both. I tend to think that New York-based celebrities have a little more together. I think L.A. is... I mean, I love to visit there, and if I had to live there, I would put a bullet in my brain. I really don't think I could do it. To live in a town that is... And every person I ever know who's... And I know a lot of actually... friends of mine from college who went out to L.A. and either are still there now or were there for a while. And they're all great people, smart, funny, very good at what they do. But there's this little sheen that kind of rubs off on them, and they all have it. And it always kind of makes me want to give them a little, you know. You run into both for sure. And you know, Meryl Streep is a brilliant, intelligent woman, and I'm deeply in love with her, actually. And Stanley Tucci is wonderful. But I think it's less about the diva thing that you see in myth and a sense that you have to protect yourself all the time because people want a piece of you all the time. And so it's sort of an occupational hazard to get that kind of not all that sincere behavior. So there's definitely a lot of that there, but there are also extraordinary, genuine and generous and intelligent people. So... you get both kinds. So that's the last question. Thank you, guys. Thank you. I'll be signing. Thank you.